Recorded from the U.S. Capitol, you're listening to the Congressional Internet Caucus Academy's podcast.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Congressional Internet Caucus Academy briefing. My name is Gracie Gilligan, and I'm with the Internet Education Foundation, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's luncheon event, The Future of Online Expression in the Trump Era, Freedom versus Regulation. The Congressional Internet Caucus was founded in 1996 and has been operating for nearly 30 years. The caucus is currently co-chaired by Congressman Michael McCaul and Congresswoman Haley Stevens in the House of Representatives and by Senator John Thune in the Senate. The briefing today is hosted by the Congressional Internet Caucus Academy. The Caucus Academy is also announcing upcoming briefings for June, July, and September discussing video streaming, energy for AI innovation, and cybersecurity. We hope to see you there. For today's event, we have a panel of experts who will be instrumental in shaping policy surrounding online expression in the coming years. Our moderator today is Ash Kazarian, Senior Legal Fellow at the Future of Free Speech out of Vanderbilt University. Ash, I'll hand it over to you to introduce the panel and get us started.
Hello, everyone. We have a great panel for you today, and I know many of you have asked me for it to be as entertaining as possible, and Tim might have a heart attack, but we're going to deliver that. We have an incredible lineup. I prefer to not read people's bios because you can look them up. So we have Jenna Leventhal from ACLU. We have Luke Hogg from the American Foundation for American Innovation, yeah. Chris Marchese for NetChoice, and then Daniel Cochran.
Yeah.
From the Heritage Foundation. You might have heard of them. So last October of 2024, the Future of Free Speech survey surveyed about 52,000 people in 33 countries on their support for free speech policies. And what we have seen was definitely confirmation for a global free speech recession. And United States was the third country after Israel and Japan where support for free speech policies has dropped significantly. Put that in the context of having online speech be the new medium through which speech is disseminated and government is focusing on to try and address the concerns they have. And you have a pretty long list of issues that we're gonna try and cover. So the first one is going to be a very non-controversial one. It will be the Federal Communications Commission and its now chair who has since, I would say about November of last year, Brendan Carr has expressed that the FCC has authority over regulating Section 230, which is as old as the Internet Caucus Association, actually, in 1996. So I'm gonna first go to Jenna and Luke and ask them, what do you think about, well, you can address it from a few different angles. What do you think about FCC having authority over regulating Section 230 in online speech? And what do you think about that as an idea? Jenna, you wanna start?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with the idea of it because I think that's really central to the ACLU's viewpoint here. I think most of you know the ACLU. If you don't, we are an organization that promotes free speech and civil liberties, and we tend to take a pretty hard line on a lot of things that have to do with speech. We're known for literally defending Nazis as well as pro-Palestinian protesters. So we've kind of fallen on both sides of the aisle there. But for us, 230 is central to the internet. 230 says that platforms aren't liable for what their users post. We think that if platforms are liable for what their users post, they're not gonna let users post. And the internet is pretty much the forum for free speech today. More so, I think, than the town square, people are going online to organize, they're going online to read news, they're going online to talk to friends and family. I mean, you're probably half of you are on your phones online randomly right now, right? It's the forum for free speech. And so if we interrupt Section 230, if the FCC steps in to interpret it in a way that is obviously intended to significantly narrow, if not repeal, Section 230, we're really concerned about what that would do to the internet and what control that would give the FCC to really like push on platforms and dictate what they want these platforms to look like. Because there's also two sides of the coin, right? For as much as we want users to be able to have the speech to post online without getting stopped because of a platform's liability, we also want platforms to have their own free speech rights to make their platform what they want them to be. And so some platforms can decide, you know, we want all of this type of content and none of this type, and that's their own right. And so I think we just think keeping Section 230 as it is a good idea. And for that reason, on policy alone, we don't want the FCC to step in and take action there.
I don't know if this is working. Oh, it is working. Cool. So I would generally agree with most of what Jenna said. I think the area of disagreement is actually not about the principle of Section 230 and the principle of intermediary liability, but the actual implementation and the way that Section 230 has been interpreted by the courts and the way that it's been used by platforms and by tech companies, right? So I think the area of disagreement that we would have is first, I mean, it literally sits in the Communications Act. So, like, if the FCC doesn't have authority to interpret Section 230, then, like, I don't know who does. But I think the deeper question is really about whether we can change Section 230. So I think there's this idea that gets floated out there that we can't do anything, or else the internet will explode. Like, the internet as we know it will just completely collapse if we like do anything to Section 230. Like, it's this, and it is this cornerstone of the internet. But we have precedent of touching Section 230. So Congress in 1998 injected intellectual property exemption for Section 230, and then FOSTA SESTA creates runarounds for Section 230 for child sexual abuse material and sexual trafficking. So there's ways in which that you can touch Section 230, that you can change these principles, and I think that fundamentally what Chairman Carr has said, and I think what the FCC wants to do, is essentially say, listen, there is a good faith aspect to Section 230 in the statute, and we're just going to interpret what that good faith actually looks like. If you want Section 230 immunity, then you have to like basically be acting in good faith. You have to provide arbitration agreements. You have to actually lay out and follow what your terms of service say, and you can't just pick and choose when you're going to apply these terms. Because, I mean, I agree that it's an essential component in most speeches going online, but that makes it all the more important that the platforms that are being the central conduit of speech in this world are also not putting their hands on the scale in terms of going one way or the other. And I think that's essentially what Chairman Carr and I think this administration have said on 230. It's not that we're gonna blow up intermediary liability, or we're necessarily gonna say that a platform is suddenly a publisher and they're gonna have to be liable for everything that happens. What they're saying is you have to play by certain rules, and you know, I don't know what the exact rules that Chairman Carr will eventually put up with, but you have to be neutral. And I think that that's, we've seen that I think we're gonna eventually get to talking about broadcasters, and the FCC has a long history of having these rules where if you're gonna be a central platform and you're gonna use public spectrum, you're going to use public access and rights of way, you're going to use public resources in order to be a speech platform, you also have to serve the public interest to a certain degree.
So I'm going to go down the line and get to both of you on this question, because I can tell you are both excited to cover it too. So I'm going to go Chris and Dan.
Sure.
Daniel.
So I think that the most important thing to keep in mind about Section 230 is that it is the most successful tort reform in U.S. history. The United States Congress did something that was very effective. It said, we want to make sure that the internet remains a place for innovation and free expression, right? And Congress looked around and said, what is the biggest threat to that? It's lawsuits. When you have, you know, tens of millions of people potentially able to sue over the decisions you make about content, well, those lawsuits, even if they end up getting tossed out of court, are going to be expensive, and they're going to act as a penalty on how you exercise your First Amendment rights as a website. And so Congress said, we don't like that. We want websites to exercise their First Amendment rights, including their First Amendment right to moderate content, right? There's a whole backstory about how we got Section 230 that has to do with the Wolf of Wall Street. Believe it or not, in the early 1990s, there were web forums, and average Americans were posting in forums about how they had concerns that Stratton Oakmont, you know, the big brokerage firm in the movie Wolf of Wall Street, was a fraud. And Stratton Oakmont sued for defamation, and they won. They won because the court said, if you do any type of content moderation, then you are responsible for every person's speech on your website. And so, of course, you know, it turned out not to be defamation, it was true. But at the time, the court was stupid and said it was defamation. But regardless, the point is, there was a penalty. There was a penalty for hosting third-party speech and for moderating, for trying to have a family-friendly website there was a penalty. And so Congress stepped in with Section 230 and said, that's unacceptable. We want there to be a lot of speech on the internet, but we also want websites to moderate that speech so that kids and families can go to it and not just see pornography. And so Section 230 is the most successful tort liability in US history, right? That's why we have as much speech and innovation online as we do. Now, in terms of the FCC, look, Section 230 is self-executing. There is nothing in that statute that tells any agency what to do precisely because Congress did not want an agency enforcing it. It is true that it's in the Communications Decency Act of 1996, but it's also true that in 1996, Congress started to deregulate our telecommunication systems, right? Now, the internet was brand new, and so Congress said, we are going to keep the agencies away from this because they ruin everything, right? Like, look at the lack of innovation in broadcast. And they said, we're not going to have that for the internet. And so they specifically did not give the FCC or any agency any authority to interpret, reinterpret, enforce, or do anything. In fact, it's only for the courts. Section 230 is a procedural shortcut for the courts to look at a lawsuit and say, is this about third-party speech? Is this about a user speech? If so, lawsuit gets tossed because you're suing the wrong person. You can sue the person who defamed you, but not the website that hosted the content, right? And there is no role for the FCC. And I think something, you know, that is an interesting intersection here is that Chair Carr has been very forward about concerns about jawboning and the things that the Biden administration did around COVID and misinformation. And yet, here's an agency that has no statutory authority claiming that it can reinterpret Section 230 and use that as a cudgel to sort of coerce some of the content moderation decisions that it would prefer to see. So, to me, that's a huge problem. And, you know, Commissioner Gomez, she's a Democrat appointee, but I find myself strongly agreeing with her in the sense of, you know, she tweeted out, like, look, if we're going to be putting out guidance on Section 230, make no mistake, it is jawboning. This is a way for the FCC to bully private companies into changing how they exercise their First Amendment rights. So, all of which is to say, Section 230 is what allows the internet to flourish, allows free speech online to flourish, and the FCC has no role, and the FCC claiming that it does is just meant to bully private companies into exercising their First Amendment rights differently.
Daniel?
I think it's notable that the FCC under the first Trump administration disagreed with Chris's statement. In fact, under Chairman Pai, at the end of the last Trump administration, I believe in November of 2020, the general counsel of the FCC issued a very long memorandum arguing for why he thought that the FCC had the authority to implement the statute that Congress had passed. And I want to make two key points. First is that the context matters. We often think of 230 as sort of this freestanding law. But it was part of a much larger statute called, I mean, obviously the Telecommunications Act, but the part of the Telecommunications Act in which Section 230 is placed is the Communications Decency Act. Now, Congress, when it enacted this law, a key concern was both, yes, ensuring that consumers exercise choice. It is right that they wanted to ensure free speech online. But another concern they had was the proliferation of obscene content, pornography, and other really dangerous material, stuff that I think we in this room, I'll just speak generationally as a millennial, that we have experienced as these platforms have become larger and larger and proliferated in all of our lives. So I think it's critical to note that a conservative Republican, I think, pro-innovation chairman of the FCC disagrees with the position that there is no authority to implement the statute. And the second point is there's really sort of two kind of underlying questions. The first is, can the agency or can the commission implement the statute through rulemaking? And I think the answer has to be yes. I think that's what commissions and agencies are charged with. They are charged with the enforcement of the law. So the real question is not, can the FCC do rulemaking on 230? The real question is, what did Congress actually mean? What was the original text What did the original text of 230 and the larger context of the law actually require? And I want to sort of punt on this because, at least in our conversation, we might want to get deeper into the legal weeds, so I don't want to go down that path quite yet, but I want to suggest to you that the answer is not obvious, and I think the Third Circuit points the way, but I'll stop there as sort of a teaser.
Yeah. Oh,
just a quick point, though. I hear you that agencies love rulemaking and they do believe it is their duty to promulgate regulations. But, you know, we have very recent Supreme Court cases, including Loper-Bright from last term, that says an agency doesn't get to point to ambiguities in a statute or the lack of statutory authority as a means to then regulate. Congress did not grant any agency to enforce or interpret Section 230, because there is nothing in it to interpret or to enforce. It is simply a tool for the courts to apply in cases. So the courts have a role, but no agency does. And after Loper-Bright, there is absolutely there's nothing to hang your hat on as an agency that claims, like, oh, Section 230, that's for us to enforce. No, I mean, the Supreme Court is clear. When Congress wants an agency to do something that is, you know, significant on social or economic policy, Congress must speak clearly. And so even if we, you know, were to agree that there was something in the Communications Decency Act of 1996 supporting the notion that Congress wanted, you know, a heavier hand in censorship, well, the fact of the matter is it's not in the law.
So I'm just going to respond to that really quickly, because I know I want to respect Ash in leading the discussion. So number one, okay, so agencies don't get special deference. So when this goes back to a case called Chevron, right? So the question there is, if there's a benefit of the doubt, if there's an ambiguity in the statute and a court doesn't know, it's not clear, there's not a clear grant from Congress of like what the intent of the law is, there's no special deference that's afforded to an administrative agency. That is true. But it doesn't do away with the fact that 230 is part of the Telecommunications Act, and that the FCC has always had, as well as other commissions and agencies, have always had the authority to implement the clear will of Congress. And so, as I say to Chris, the question here is, what does the statute actually say? Because what the statute actually says determines whether or not the FCC can intervene or not intervene, but rather implement the statute. And that's, I think, what this whole conversation comes down to, is what is the context in which Congress enacted 230, and how should we read 230? That's the real, I think, key point here.
I think the exciting thing is that if FCC does go down this road, we will find out if Loper-Bright has changed the admin law rules here. And I know admin law usually sounds boring, but this one is going to be exciting, so stay tuned. Daniel, you said something that made me think of ACLU. The Reno versus ACLU case and obscenity that stemmed from Communications Decency Act. I feel like you're the best person to speak on it, Jenna.
Yeah. So. I want to actually start with a little First Amendment lesson. I think that's a helpful framing for this panel, right? What does the First Amendment protect? Almost all speech, with a handful of exceptions. Defamation. Obscenity, with a very specific legal definition. Porn, for the most part, protected speech. Like, that's why porn exists and people can watch it. It's considered protected speech. And so I think what's important to know about the First Amendment is that speech is protected, in limited categories it's not, and that's how we need to be looking at all these things. What Daniel is essentially saying is, oh my God, some of this stuff is bad and some of this stuff is offensive, and so we need to stop everyone from seeing it. But the reason the First Amendment exists is because people don't agree on what's good and what's bad, and I think that's very clear in the world today, right? People don't agree on what's good and what's bad. And if you give the government the power to say, this is good, this is bad, you can only see this, you can only see that, then do we have a democracy? Not really, right? We don't. So I think what's the reminder here is, while the intentions are good and people think, oh my God, this is bad, we need to protect people from this, ultimately, the First Amendment exists because the government can't get involved in that, because we don't want the government telling people what is okay for them and what's not okay for them to see and what's not okay for them to say. And so 230 really just enables that exercise of free speech and doesn't let someone who is offended by something come in and say that because they're offended by it, no one else is able to see it. And so I think that needs to underpin this entire conversation.
Luke, I think you wanted to do like a class exercise.
If I can get this turned on. So I agree with Jenna, and I think that you know, where I would come down on some of this is really that, I mean, obviously you have a right to express your speech as much as possible, but when I'm talking about Section 230 and what platforms are doing, it's actually more about how a private party has the right to curtail or change or modify or amplify or degrade the free speech of another private individual. You know, I think that's an interesting question. But I, you know, going back to 230, specifically, I'm actually a little curious. How many people in this room actually ever used CompuServe or Prodigy or a bulletin board system at all? 3, 4, 5? Okay. This was passed in 1996. And my question to Chris and Jenna, which I mean, if Chairman Carr decides to move forward with this, I will assume that probably one of your two organizations, or perhaps both, will sue him for doing so. Do you think that if we pass Section 230 today, that it would be the exact same as Cox and Wyden did, in what they admit was kind of a half-assed way? Like, they injected this at the last minute into Section 230. I mean, like, it's not technically 27 words, but it's really short, right? Do you think that if we had this debate in Congress today, that the result would be the exact same? Or do you think that there would be some more nuance to the way Section 230 is interpreted and developed as a statute?
As the moderator, I'm gonna take the privilege of asking the questions. I'm gonna modify what you said with the caveat that, you know, like, the Constitution was passed a while ago and I don't think you wanna change that. Like the argument of, it's been 30 years. I don't know if that works. So the question you're asking, although I also do want to say, I don't think Ron Wyden and Chris Cox have said that they have asked anything.
The opposite.
The question you're asking is, do you think we would have Section 230 if Congress was grappling with the question of, should platforms be liable for third-party user speech? And I'm going to ask Jenna and Chris. Chris, you want to go first?
So I think, you know, just Google or use DuckDuckGo because there's robust competition in the marketplace. But, you know, just search for Chris Cox, Ron Wyden, Section 230 history, and you will see that this was over a year in the making. It was incredibly deliberate. They worked really hard to bring their colleagues on board. They had briefings, hearings, negotiations. It was a very deliberate law. So do I think that we would have Section 230 written the exact same way today? No, I would hope that today Congress would say there is no neutrality requirement, even though that should be clear on the face of the statute. But to the extent that people misunderstand that, we're going to put it in there that, you know, explicitly it does not require you to violate your First Amendment rights in order to achieve, you know, immunity. So I think that's true. But I just want to bring it back to the fact that Congress can always legislate. As was pointed out earlier, you know, Section 230 has been amended, most recently with the FOSTA-SESTA amendments of 2018. So if Congress would like to change Section 230, it can. But I think ultimately what's significant to note is that whether you're on the left or the right, you know, people are complaining about how Section 230 applies, and that to me signals that it's working exactly as intended, right? It should not be something that makes our politicians happy, because it is, again, sort of enabling private publishers of billions of pieces of content to exercise their First Amendment rights without government coercion or influence. That is, of course, going to piss people off.
So how many of you folks in the room, with a show of hands, know about SESTA-FOSTA, know what it's about? Okay, great. This is such an educated audience. This is great. Jenna, just quickly, do you want to talk about SESTA-FOSTA and what ACLU has seen as a result of it?
Yeah, so SESTA-FOSTA, child sex trafficking, what we've actually seen is platforms proactively censor a lot of other speech, not just speech about, or not just content about child sex trafficking and things that enable that. We've seen sex workers have their forums where they discuss safety measures completely shut down. We've seen content about sexual and reproductive care shut down, taken down. We see that also under platform sort of existing terms of service. I think one thing that's really interesting is, I guess we don't have a platform here today, but most of the platforms, the way they moderate is through AI essentially, right? And so these AI systems aren't that good at being able to tell the difference between different things, right? Like, they are not going to know if I am sharing my story about how I was sex trafficked versus someone trying to do sex trafficking. And those, speech-wise, are very different things, right? One is a crime, and one is someone sharing their experience and their story. But they have the same keywords. They might have the same images. And so a lot of these systems aren't capable of that. And so what we see, what we've seen with SESTA-FOSTA and continue to see, is the takedown of a lot of protected speech that gets mixed up in this thing that has been removed from Section 230 protections.
I do want to, we have so much to cover, as I said at the beginning. So I'm going to move on to the FTC portion of the evening. And I'm going to go to Daniel maybe first. Trump at FTC has been very active on a lot of fronts, and they are currently have an inquiry with, I believe, due date of May 21st, where they've asked anyone, you know, the general public, to submit their experience with maybe being censored by platforms or how they see the platform's community policies, content policies versus their experience on them. Now, they haven't said explicitly what they are going to do post this inquiry, but I have a feeling they're not just going to read it and move on. What do you think of this action and what it possibly could mean?
Sure, and I'm going to actually respond really quick. So I think to your point about obscenity, there is a compelling interest in preventing minors from accessing porn. And to the extent that we treat obscenity the same as we do political and religious speech, I think we need to go back and look at that. I think we need to take an originalist approach to the First Amendment. To Ash's very good question about the FTC, I think it's really important to note that we assume that when platforms have these content moderation and recommender algorithms, that they are engaged in first-party expression, right? That's sort of the underlying premise of, and I assume we'll get into the Paxton Moody case. So often, it's not at all the case that these companies are doing that. So often, what's happening is these companies are creating, say, AI, so using large language models, right, that are trained on a plethora of data. And a lot of times, the companies don't even understand how the models are operating. So the way that they enforce their rules, especially now that we're moving into the AI space, has become even more vague and opaque. It was already vague and opaque before. And I think one thing to note is, you know, during the COVID pandemic in 2020, thanks to investigations by the House Judiciary Committee, by litigation like Murphy v. Missouri, we now sort of have an extensive record, not just of the collusion between government and private actors, but we also have a pretty good idea of what was going on the platform side. And I think, I mean, it's probably not news to people in this room that platforms were using their considerable power to action millions of pieces of content, right? And this is not just, we think about like the high profile cases, right? Now, obviously, I think those are problematic. But you know, the real problem with censorship is how it affects ordinary, normal Americans who don't get a say. They get no due process. They don't even know what's going on. And like, you know, shadow banning, which we now know has been happening on these platforms all the time, basically just means that your content gets demoted. You may not get, you know, explicitly taken down or off the platform, or it may not be that your account is banned, but your content essentially is invisible. And often that happens without any due process whatsoever. And that gets to Ash's question about the FTC. So Chairman Ferguson, you know, has long said that censorship, the way that these companies, because they are service providers, they have commercial contracts with their users, And as a provider, as a platform that enables these individuals, millions and millions of Americans, to generate, share, and create and engage with each other's speech, these platforms also have consumer protection requirements, both under federal and state law. And so I think one of the keys about the FTC request for information is the FTC is giving normal Americans the opportunity to tell their stories. Because as I said, we got a rare glimpse into what these platforms were doing during 2020, and we only got a glimpse because we had the courts intervene after multiple states, including Louisiana and Missouri, sued the Biden administration, and the House Judiciary Committee opened an extensive investigation. And look, I think this is the commission sending a clear message to normal Americans. We care about you. We care about how your services are affected, and we want to hear your stories. I'll just share one because I think it's really important. There was a YouTuber, and I've got to know him personally. There's a YouTuber, he had a decently large following. He posted for years about political content on YouTube. He created an entire business around his YouTube content on all kinds of political matters. He hired staff, right? So it was his family, the family of his staff that was supported by this business. One day, YouTube, without explanation, demonetized his channel. He asked repeatedly, what can I do? What was the policy violation here? After months of going back and forth with Google, they refused to even explain to him what he had done to violate their policy. So I'm just like, let's just cabin the question of, can the platforms do this stuff? Let's just put that to the side for a second. Shouldn't the YouTuber who's built his entire livelihood and the livelihood of his employees and all the followers, to his 2 million followers, shouldn't he have at least the right to due process? Shouldn't he have at least the right to know if the platform is preventing the 2 million people who chose to follow him from seeing his content? That, I think, is what's at stake here and what the FTC request for information is getting at. Is the normal Americans affected by the censorship?
What was his name?
I'm not going to share that here in this context, but I'll.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But 2 million followers—that's a lot.
Yeah.
Chris, do you want to talk about the FTC?
Sure. So my views on the FTC don't differ that much from the FCC, except to add that the FTC is even scarier because it holds even more regulatory power, right? You know, obviously, tech companies are under the antitrust gun at the moment, and so, you know, additional investigations into their content moderation policies, which violate the First Amendment, are not great, but it's especially not great when it's coming from an agency that is also responsible for potentially breaking up your company, right? So that in of itself should be recognized as a point of leverage, and the government knows very well that it holds that leverage. In fact, it's not very different at all from the Biden White House, emailing Meta or other companies saying, hey, we really don't like the way that you're moderating some of your content. In fact, when Meta pointed out to the White House that the First Amendment exists, the White House sort of laughed. Quite frankly, that seems quite consistent with how the FTC is also approaching this, right? The FTC has a mandate to protect consumers and to enforce the antitrust laws. That is true. But fraud has victims. Hurt feelings from content moderation has pundits. And I think the FTC is forgetting that it has a duty to enforce the law, not to use the law as leverage in unrelated context. So I hear Daniel's point about, you know, maybe there are genuine harms in the marketplace that the FTC should look at. But the fact of the matter is, the FTC is going way beyond its mandate, and it's trying to make disagreements over content moderation into actionable fraud or actionable harm that allows the agency to step in. And that's just false. And I think, you know, to the extent that people have concerns about how content moderation works, well, listen, our members, right, you know, NetChoice is a trade association, our members include all of the usual guys and a ton more, that if you have disagreements with how they exercise their First Amendment rights, you really do have a choice in the marketplace. And our members do respond to market pressure. I mean, you saw this with Meta announcing that it was going to walk back its fact-checking program, that it was going to change the way that it moderated content or used algorithms to moderate certain content. That is Meta responding to pressure from the marketplace. And so when Americans say that they want a less moderated internet experience, platforms will respond. And there is nothing for the FTC to do. And I think that's the way we want to keep it, because again, if we're concerned about jawboning, it shouldn't matter whether it's the White House, the FCC, or the FTC. The fact of the matter is, it's the government using its power in inappropriate and unconstitutional ways.
So we are going to try and have some time for Q&A. So I'm going to move on to the next part of what's going on with online speech, which is Congress. I'm going to go to Luke and Jenna first. Luke, is there anything with online speech related? That's not just Section 230. You know, there's been some conversations about job bonding bills, sure. Some other things. Feel free to highlight whatever you
just
prefer.
Anything? I could just talk about anything.
Anything online speech related? Yes.
No, I mean, I think that when Congress is looking at these issues, whether it's Kids Online Safety Act, whether it's we're talking about job boning, whether we're talking about the FTC's inquiry, I mean, I think that the fundamental issue that we're seeing here is that people feel like they don't have choice. And, you know, I would respectfully push back against Chris that he says, listen, there's so much competition in the market. You can just do whatever you want. Federal courts have all recently disagreed with him, at least on Google, and I think are likely to disagree with him on the amount of competition and the amount of choice that users have across the ecosystem. So while I don't think that the solution to that is, you know, some people have proposed very radical remedies for some of these problems, you know, breaking up Google, who has now lost two federal antitrust lawsuits, and you know, going after some of these big companies in very dramatic ways. I think the fundamental issue is that we're looking at ways that you can give users more choice in this ecosystem, and you can give them empowerment, because these people don't. Parents don't feel empowered, and that's why we're having these conversations about COSA and COPPA 2.0 and age verification online. I mean, users don't feel empowered to have choice and to know what's going on. I mean, you agree with these terms of service, and to the FTC point, I mean, it's like the fundamental issue that the FTC is looking at is whether the company is abiding by the contract that you're signing with it. When you sign terms of service, that's a contract. Is the company abiding by it? I have no idea. But I respect the fact that legislators and regulators are looking at some of those issues. So I think, you know, I'll respectfully dodge the question a little bit on specific legislation. But I think that the more that we can talk about this in context of giving users more choice, giving consumers more choice, giving consumers more power in the market, that's where this conversation needs to be happening, not about whether there needs to be like more competition among regular players. We gotta recenter this conversation about like what the average person is actually dealing with online.
Jenna?
To dodge the question less, not that you didn't fully dodge the question. I mean, I think most of the debates that we're seeing right now in Congress are focused on kids' online safety, right? There is a rumored Durbin Section 230 sunset bill that we haven't seen yet. So I think most of the debates that we're actively seeing are Kids Online Safety Act, Kids Off Social Media Act, all of these bills that are seeking to protect kids online. But ultimately, what almost all of these bills do is they, for COSA, for example, give the FTC the ability to make the choice, what is and isn't safe for kids to see. I think there have been efforts to reform COSA, efforts to say, oh, this isn't about the speech, this is about, you know, the platform design feature. And then you drill down further, and I ask some of you in the audience who are staffers, like, what is your boss concerned about? And, oh, my boss is concerned about their kids seeing content about eating disorders. And I'm like, yes, there you go. Like, this is about speech, right? So I think we are concerned that in these efforts to protect kids, what the government is actually doing is giving the FTC the ability to decide what is and isn't okay for kids across the country to see, and what is and isn't okay for kids across the country to say. And also, you know, threatening the availability of content online for adults as well. Some of the other pieces of legislation, Kids Off Social Media Act, are full-throated bans of kids creating social media accounts, period. And I always kind of like to remind people, kids also have First Amendment rights. Like, just like adults, kids have First Amendment rights. And it's ultimately, you know, when a parent gets involved in, you know, protecting their kid from the internet, cool, have fun. Like, that's what a parent should be doing. When platforms decide what they can and can't have on their platform, that's the platform's own First Amendment, right? But the issue comes when the government steps in and tries to say, we think this content is harmful, please take it down. And that's ultimately, I think, the goal of most of these kids' online safety bills. And so we don't think they actually do that much to make kids safer. What they do is threaten everyone's free speech rights.
So over the past few years, we've seen some states pass legislation that's been challenged in court, often by a little trade association called NetChoice. And I want to talk about the courts and the Supreme Court. I'll start with you, Daniel, because you said something that was fascinating to me as a First Amendment lawyer. You said the originalist interpretation of the First Amendment. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, or overall how you're seeing the cases unfold, whatever you want to highlight in the court section?
Sure. I'm going to cabin the comment about obscenity because I think that would take us down a different path that we're not going to go down right now. But I do want to turn to, I think, the important case, Anderson v. TikTok. And this gets to the 230 point. In that case, people in this room are probably generally aware of what that case was. A 10-year-old girl, Nyla Anderson, saw a blackout challenge video. It was a video that was suggested and recommended to her in the For You page on TikTok. And it's a challenge that encourages young people to try to self-asphyxiate, basically hang themselves, strangle themselves. She attempted to do so, and she died as a result. Her family is now suing in litigation against TikTok, claiming that they are strictly liable. And so the question is, in this case, well, does 230 immunize the platform against the I believe it's a state claim. You correct me if I'm wrong about that. The district court, Eastern District of Pennsylvania, concluded that, in fact, 230 does provide immunity. The Third Circuit took up that case and reversed it. And I think the key, and I'll, you know, we can talk about the nuances here, but the key there is that the court drew on the NetChoice Moody and Paxton decisions. And this is where it's critical. The court said Moody and Paxton understand or recognize that certain kinds of algorithms, not every algorithm, but certain kinds of algorithms appear to be expression on the part of the platform. Now it's critical, and because of that, they conclude, so 230 only applies to third-party speech, not to first-party speech. So they concluded on that basis that the platform is engaged in first-party speech and therefore not immunized by 230. But critically, and this is important, Judge Mady, who joined in the judgment, so he concurred in the judgment but dissented in the reasoning, points out that the court need not reach the question of whether these algorithms are first-party speech to conclude that they're not, in fact, immunized by 230. And that is because, and he goes back, recites the history of the difference between publisher and distributor liability. And it's sort of, I don't want to risk sort of getting, that's really nuanced, and I don't want to take us down that path too far, but the, in very like short, brief terms, the difference is that in product liability, it's strict liability, so you're talking about the sort of the either first-person speech or first-person action, but distributor liability is a looser kind of liability that you had reason to believe that a particular design feature or a particular conduct that you facilitated resulted in a harm. So again, we could get into that down that road, but what's critical, I think, to note is that essentially this I think clarifies the original, we talked about the original intent. Ash was asking about the originalist view of the First Amendment. I think this is really good statutory interpretation because it's looking at the text, history, and tradition of 230, and it's distinguishing the line of cases out of which 230 arose. Chris talked about one of those earlier, in which the courts were trying to figure out with the early bulletin boards how to essentially determine whether publisher or distributor liability applied. And Judge Mady notes in his dissent/concurrence that in fact that this was premised on 230 was premised on protecting the hosting of content, not all of the other decisions and not all the other conduct that the platform is engaged with. So this has two really key implications. Number one, it means that 230 ought not apply to a lot of these design decisions that put kids in harm's way and that it cause other harms. Number two, it means that the platforms are not necessarily engaged in speech when they have algorithms that are involved in how content is presented. Now, Chris is probably about to say, well, we have Paxton and Moody. And we get into Paxton and Moody, but Paxton and Moody was a very narrow decision in a procedural posture on a very limited factual record. So I think we ought to be very careful not to overstate that case, but also to recognize what the court was doing in the Anderson case as well.
But you just cited Paxton and Moody yourself, so I'm...
Well, I'm saying that the court in Anderson, the majority, so it's a three-judge panel, and two of those judges said the reason why you're immunized from liability under 230 is because we think you're engaged in first-party expression. I'm saying Judge Mady's point is you need not conclude that you're engaged in expression, that the platform is engaged in expression to conclude that the platform is still liable, meaning that they're not immunized by 230. I'm saying that's a really important distinction. And I'm saying that there is a tendency perhaps to overread Paxton and Moody to say that any algorithm that in any way affects the way that content is displayed or organized is the platform's first party expression, when the court was very clear, and Justice Kagan in writing the opinion was very clear, that it's only true insofar as algorithms are doing the same thing as a newspaper editor or close to that.
I don't think I'm understanding you, but we don't have a lot of time, so Chris.
So I'm actually going to start with some First Amendment originalism. Go back to the founding and think about our founding fathers and the fact that they used very partisan newspapers to get their messages out, right? Like the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and then, you know, the New York Daily News, right? That was Alexander Hamilton's hit piece against his political opponents. And so since the very beginning of this country, we have recognized the power of publishers to not just promote their own views, but also to sort of influence the general public. And from the very beginning, when the First Amendment was passed, we have had a very strong protection for letting publishers make their own decisions about what to publish, how to publish, and when to publish. And something that is, you know, kind of interesting about the American context is, like, while we did take a lot of liability rules from, you know, the British common law and all that, we did break new ground in the colonies. You know, defamation was a strict liability tort in the UK, whereas in the US, the Peter Zenger trial actually introduced truth as an absolute defense to defamation claims. So even if you are, you know, technically defaming somebody under common law, if it's truthful, then there is no defamation. That was an American innovation. And that was a jury system that came up with that, and that is now enshrined and good law in the United States. So we have always had a more protective view of speech than the Anglo-Saxon tradition. Now, moving on from that, you kind of fast forward to Section 230, the Moody-Paxton litigation and all of that, and all we are doing is sort of making clear that the First Amendment protects contemporary publishers too. Right? Whatever you feel about social media, the fact is they are engaged in publishing speech, their own speech and third-party speech. And they are also exercising their editorial rights when they decide how to serve you, the user, the speech that it thinks you want to see. And of course algorithms are used, right? It's, you know, no different from when newspapers started using spell check. I don't think anybody would claim that the New York Times switching over to, you know, Microsoft Word and using spell check to fix some of its mistakes, you know, renders it unprotected speech, right? That's just crazy. And I would also say that, you know, when it comes to algorithms and so forth, if they don't do anything in terms of like expressive content or expressive conduct or, you know, sort of symbolizing the platform's views on what makes a good online forum, then we wouldn't be sitting here complaining about how they exercise that, right? Like, either algorithms do nothing, or they do specifically what we're complaining about, which is moderate content in a way that we would do differently. I know for myself that I would never have removed the New York Post story about, you know, Hunter Biden's laptop. But it's in recognizing that, right? It's precisely by recognizing that that we have to understand that the First Amendment is so important here. It's precisely because we would make different judgment calls that we have to protect everybody else's right to do that, right? And so, you know, and if we want to get into some like original intent, which I don't really love, but let's go with originalism and textualism and look at Section 230. It uses the term publisher. And we know from the Supreme Court that we have to define that term as it was commonly understood in 1996. If you look at any of the authoritative dictionaries that the Supreme Court has cited, you will see that publisher, as understood in 1996, meant everything from the decisions about what content to include to what content to exclude, how to display that content, disseminate that content, and how to distribute it. So distributor liability is actually just a form of publisher liability. So when Congress decided to grant immunity for publisher liability, it did so with the understanding that it was protecting far more than just hosting third-party speech. And of course, you know, Section 230 has other provisions, including C2, which says when you moderate content, you are not then a first-party speaker who is liable for it. You are simply exercising your First Amendment rights concurrent with a user, and that is still granted immunity. And of course, there is, I think it's subsection 7, but don't quote me on that. But there is a subsection that talks about sort of like device filtering technology and other forms of technology that can be used to sort of display content. And so Congress very clearly, even in 1996, understood that it was going to be granting immunity beyond just the hosting of third-party speech. It was also granting immunity for how that speech is moderated, curated, and disseminated.
So we only have 10 minutes left, and I did promise as a community guideline that I was going to do a Q&A, and I don't want FTC to come after me. So if you have a question that all of our panelists can answer, please raise your hand. All right, we have one.
There are telecom attorneys in this room. I'm not one of them. You can talk to them afterwards.
I'm a moderator, so I was told I can't have opinions. So, Chris?
I think it should already be moot because of Loper Bright and all the other administrative law decisions from the Roberts Court that indicates you gotta point to something specific in the text that authorizes you to do what it is you're claiming you want to do. And there is nothing in Section 230 granting any agency. In fact, just a fun aside, and yes, this is legislative history, so forgive me. Like, when Congress passed Section 230, they literally joked, thank God we are not forming an FCC, Federal Computer Commission, right? So it was designed specifically to rely on the free market and not government enforcers. I get that times have changed since 1996, but the fact is, that is still the law. And so there is nothing, it should already be moot. It should be a non-starter.
Daniel or Jenna, do you want to answer that, or should we get a number?
I could respond, but I don't have.
Sure.
Okay, quickly. I'm gonna punch on your point, but in terms of the history of 230, I'm hearing two things. Earlier in the panel, I brought up how 230 was part of the larger Communications Decency Act, that one of the goals of Congress there was to create more choice for individuals to choose how their information environments are mediated and curated. And also, that was underlined by a concern, so the good faith blocking provision, which is C2 of Section 230, right, when we talk about good faith and it has that list, lascivious, libelous, filthy, Congress was concerned about the proliferation of pornography on the early internet. So when we talk about intent, I mean, Jenna earlier said, oh, well, obscenity is protected speech, and that's a different question than asking what was the intent of Congress when they created this statute. The intent of 230 was user empowerment. It was to give users more choice, and it was also to enable the small startups, the small companies, which were in their infancy at that time. I mean, Google, I think, they started in the basement in like the late 90s or something, or the garage, the Palo Alto garage in the late 90s, right? So Google wasn't even on the scenes yet. And the reality is that the purpose of 230 was empowering the user and empowering the small players to challenge the giants. That was the promise of the early internet, a decentralized ecosystem. That made perfect sense at the time. But the reality is that the little guys, the little startups have become the giants, and 230 has created an incentive that only allows those companies to continue to dominate the information space.
So since I punted earlier, I'll unpunt now and go with like crazy moonshot idea. I think that part of the problem is we're talking about a lot of this, and the last time we touched the Telecommunications Act was 1996, when like Prodigy and CompuServe, which aren't even companies anymore, were doing this. Like when we're talking about broadcast regulations, which we didn't really get to, when we're talking about 230, when we're talking about, you know, these questions, all of these questions, I think deserve much much more robust discussion, and like maybe it's time to retouch the Telecommunications Act. Like, we only have three titles, maybe we need four or five, I don't know. But like, if Congress is gonna do something, I think, and address a lot of these questions, I think that that's the obvious place to start.
We have, who else has questions, raise your hand. I'm gonna actually take all of them at the same time and then use moderator privilege to adjust. Do you wanna go first?
Yes, I'd like to ask about the role of self-regulation and different regulation from third parties. Is there a role in which organizations can come together, companies can come together, and build their own guiding principles that would not then force the government to come in and develop free speech or laws that would impede free speech?
Great.
Just curious how the FCC action will change if it's a rulemaking versus a third party ruling which is trying to influence the court's opinions.
Like, or guidance.
Yeah, well, let's get to the third. So I'm going to take those three questions. One was about self-regulation, was about FCC, telecom, wonky admin law things. And one was about basically jawboning and government having power over speech, and turn them into, what do you think are the inflection points for the rest of the year that might address any of those, or maybe those are the solutions? And I'm gonna give each of you 40 seconds. We're gonna go Jenna, Luke, Chris, Daniel.
I'll start with the self-regulation. I think that that's a very constitutional way of doing things because, like I said, the First Amendment only talks about government regulation. It does not talk about these third-party actors. And so if they come together and decide what they do or want to do, the ACLU doesn't have a First Amendment problem with it. I can't talk to the wonky admin law stuff because that's very admin-y.
I would generally agree on the self-regulation. I like self-regulation. I like standards when they work. I like non-binding standards. Like NIST has a role and Commerce has a role that I don't think we've talked about here. To the question about jawboning, I think one of the inflection points for the remainder of the year and for the remainder of the Trump administration is going to be the executive order on jawboning. It's interesting to see how that'll be implemented. I think it's a very positive thing that we've seen come out of, you know, people complain. When Biden was in office, the right was complaining about jawboning. Now that Trump's in office, the left is complaining about jawboning. So maybe it's just a power problem. And hopefully we can take some of the lessons from this executive order and pass them into statute, because it's just an executive order. It's just a piece of paper.
Fully agree that Congress should pass a law that prohibits jawboning, right? I mean, it has to be carefully tailored because there are legitimate conversations that the government should be having with private businesses to, you know, for national security reasons or whatever. But the fact is Congress should definitely act in this space, because whether it's a Republican president or a Democrat president, the point has already been proved that the White House can exercise considerable coercion over private parties, and that extends to every government agency that has any type of regulatory power over a private business. So that is definitely ripe for Congress. I think another, you know, point that we're seeing is, you know, NetChoice is now involved in 17 lawsuits, and so we are actively interpreting and enforcing the Moody decision, and we're doing so against various state laws that attempt to regulate how people access constitutionally protected speech online. And so we're seeing that play out, but what is really sort of interesting is that the courts are all coalescing around a similar bundle of First Amendment rights. And so, you know, I think as these decisions come out, that is also going to weigh on Congress's consideration of things like COSA, which, you know, for what it's worth, is, in my opinion, very unconstitutional, and you can look to our lawsuits for why that is. And then the last thing, of course, is, you know, what are we going to do about generative AI? You know, we see a ton of lawsuits popping up that have copyright claims and so forth, but there is also a question of, like, you know, when AI generates an output that somebody doesn't like or that does, you know, have some type of negative impact on someone, you know, what do we do then? How should the courts interpret it? And so Section 230 might offer some answers, it might not, but that is going to be the next big thing, I think, for lawmakers to look at.
Yeah, I think basic due process and transparency for platforms, especially with AI, I think a lot of the challenge here is we see so little of what happens on the platform side of the ledger, especially with the really complicated generative AI LLMs. It's really, really, really hard to know, how are the companies enforcing? If they're, you know, if Paxton said it's expressive, if they are enforcing their, what did they say, guidelines and standards, what are those guidelines and standards with a, you know, language model with billions of parameters, right? That's general purpose. I think also more granularly for social media platforms, just the ability for users to know how their content is being treated. You know, if I'm a YouTuber, I gave the example with 2 million followers and, you know, YouTube is preventing those followers from seeing my content. It seems like a basic notice requirement would be quite reasonable. And it would seem to me that if we're talking about allowing the free market to work, reducing the information asymmetries between the users and the platforms, that's what's necessary to ensure good consumer choice. But I think it's also necessary to realign the platform's incentives with the normal Americans that rely on them.
Can I just add one quick thing?
Oh my gosh, okay.
So sorry. Okay, there's another case, everybody, we haven't talked about it, but it's X versus Bonta. You know, Twitter sued the state of California because California tried to do exactly what Daniel's talking about and won.
It's not what they required.
It required,
continue this conversation.
That is not
just Google
true.
The case, X versus Bonta.
If you folks want to hear more about X versus Bonta, the TikTok divestiture that's not happening, I don't know, or generative AI and liability, you can tell that man right there, Tim, but he should invite all of us back and have another discussion on that. I want to thank my wonderful panelists for an incredibly important discussion and all of you for being here with us. Thank you.